All right, so we're looking at chapter 11, page overhead 8, and we're starting off here. I think we fill this in. Actually, I think we just finished this, didn't we? Or we just started this, didn't we? And there we go. Okay. So we're talking about types of catalysis. Types of catalysis. Shall we go back and review what types of catalysis there were? Let's see here. Where did that end up at? I don't think it was here. Was it here? No, wasn't there. And was it? No, wasn't here. And yeah, there it is. Acid base. So we just finished acid base. We're now looking at covalent. We'll also look at metal ion this morning. Then we'll look at these next two effects, which are relevant to all enzyme catalysis, and you help increase it. So we've looked at general acid-base catalysis. We've looked at a specific example using an RNA ACE. Now we're going to be looking at what they call covalent catalysis. And so there are, in fact, there are two blanks on this page. Two blanks. First one is called covalent. Second is called nucleophilic. Nucleophilic. Then we take a look at a summary of the various nucleophiles and various electrophiles. Now, again, do you understand why, in order to have biochemistry, you've had to have organic chemistry first? Biochemistry literally is applied organic. Okay, and most physicians, dentists, pharmacists are applied biochemists. And so, covalent catalysis is really very simple. That means somewhere in the process of the mechanism, there is a covalent bond formed. Duh. That occurs much more readily than you might suspect. It's occurring right now if you've had anything for breakfast in your digestive tract. A lot of the enzymes, digestive enzymes, use covalent catalysis. Typically what happens is, the most common is nucleophilic catalysis, where there is where this thing acts as a nucleophile. And so it both must be a good nucleophile and a good leaving group. Those two things are not always embodied in the same structure. So the three steps of this, of course, there's the nucleophile and a substrate bond. So there must be some nucleophilic attack. Then after that, there is some electron withdrawal from the reaction center. And then you finally break the bond, and the catalyst, that is the enzyme, and the products separate. Let's take a look at what nucleophiles exist. Very common nucleophile is an ROH. Can you tell me what side chains have an ROH on them? Someone said it. Serine. What's another one? Threonine. Then we have an RSH. That happens every once in a while. Can you tell me what amino acid has that as a part of the side chain? Cysteine. Yes, indeed. Then we have an amine group. The nucleophile here comes whenever the loss of a proton and that lone pair electron becomes the nucleophile. All right? What side chain has NH3 or NH as a part of its side chain? What is it? Asparagine? Yeah. And lysine. Lysine primarily, but asparagine does have a free NH3 with it. That's correct. Then you have this imidazole group. Once it loses its proton, it can become a nucleophilic. What amino acid side chain has an imidazole group with it? Histidine. Again, I understand memorizing those side chains where it was a pain, but here we are seeing application immediately of it, that you can link the structure and the function. That's the piece that is important. Electrophiles, of course, protons, metal ions, lots of metal ions here that you use as electrophiles in biochemical reactions. Lots of zinc and copper and iron are used as electrophiles. Carbonic anhydrase has a zinc metal ion. the carbonyl group, and then, of course, the cationic imine. So here you see that carbon double-bonded nitrogen is called an imine. That's the organic chemistry name for it. Biochemists many times call it a shift base. Say shift base. Do not forget it. It's one of those things you have just, it's one of a myriad of details you have to kick back in your mind, because you're going to see a shift base created in the mechanism in the urea cycle and other cycles that deal with nitrogen metabolism. A shift base, a very common intermediate in the mechanism. All right, so what's going on here? Well, you have a situation here where you have acetoacetate. Now, just as a little note, would you please write next to it in quotes, quote, ketone body, close quote. Ketone body, acetoacetate. It is water-soluble fat equivalent. You're going to see this when we get to fat metabolism. It plays an important role in diabetes and uncontrolled diabetes. Ketone body. There are two mechanisms that you see here. You see an uncatalyzed mechanism, and then you see a catalyzed mechanism. The top row deals with the uncatalyzed mechanism. This does occur spontaneously, and at high concentrations of acetoacetate occurs enough that you find there's actually a significant amount of acetone form. So you see here, here's where the electrons move on to the carbon-carbon double bond here. There's a negative charge as an intermediate on the oxygen. Then there's a hydrogen ion comes in, and you get this acetone. That's the uncatalyzed form of it. It does spontaneously occur. However, here, if you have an enzyme available for it, and you don't always do, but you have an enzyme available with it, there, one of the mechanisms is it comes in and replaces that double-bonded oxygen to form this imine. The carbon dioxide then has a much greater chance of being released. You get this amine structure. The electrons rearrange, and you get this imine structure again. The enzymatic production is that finally another water comes in. Actually, this looks like a hydroxide, but it's actually equivalent of a water, and you get this acetone. This new pathway is actually at a lower activation energy than the spontaneous one you see up here, the uncatalyzed form up here, and this occurs much more rapidly with that shift-based intermediate. This kind of reaction doesn't occur all that often in the catalyzed form in your blood, but just as something to remember in the future, high levels of badly managed diabetes has high levels of fatty acids in the blood and fatty acid equivalents, one of which is a set of molecules called ketone bodies. Ketone bodies. One of those ketone bodies, of which there are three, one of them turns out to be this acetoacetate. So poorly managed diabetes, and when they're having an acute attack, dumps lots of water-soluble fat equivalents into the blood because the body is signaling, without insulin, it's signaling that there's no energy in the blood, no food equivalents, especially for the brain. So the liver starts dumping carbohydrate and fat equivalents into the blood as fast as it can. It produces copious amounts of ketone bodies, one of which is acetoacetate. It spontaneously loses the carbon dioxide, and you can get significant amounts of acetone in the blood. And you find this comatose person on the floor on the street, on the sidewalk, and you get close to them, and you begin to smell their breath, and it smells sweet. And it turns out you're smelling that acetone, and you need to get them insulin as soon as you can. Need to get them to the emergency room as soon as you can. So, just as an aside, and you'll see that again, but this has this whole aspect of this rearrangement of acetoacetate has a direct relationship to human health. Let's go ahead. Next slide. This is an illustration of the metal ion catalysis. There are three blanks on this overhead number 9. The first blank is binding. The next blank is redox states. And the last blank is negative. Those three, please write them in at this point. I'll pause to deliver something to Mr. Brummett. And thank you very much, both. All right, so now let's go on and take a look at what's going on here. Again, this is carbonic anhydrase. You recall that from the use in red blood cells dealing with the production of what compound from carbon dioxide and water? What? Oh, yes, I'm sorry. what do you produce? What does carbonic anhydrase produce when it combines water and carbon dioxide? Carbonic acid. What are you drinking when you drink pop? At least not flat pop. What are you drinking? Carbon dioxide and water. So the gas that's pressurizing the liquid is carbon dioxide, and even without a catalyst, high concentrations of carbon dioxide in water will produce small amounts of carbonic anhydrase. So it gives you a bit of a tart taste. Pop has, it's a basically, you know what sweet tarts are, right? You've had these little candies. Well, pop is basically a liquid sweet tart. And the tartness comes from the carbonic acid that's in the pop that comes from the pressurized carbon dioxide. Okay? And so you drink it, and it tastes good. If you set it out, even if it's cold, you set it out for several hours, what happens to the carbon dioxide? Releases. What happens to the carbonic acid content of the water? It drops. Cold, flat pop doesn't taste very good because it's really sweet. Warm pop is even sweeter. Okay? Warm, flat pop is almost undrinkable because it is so sweet. There's no tart to counteract the sweetness. Plus, when it's warm, the cold almost instantaneously deadens the sweet sensation in your tongue. So when you have cold pop, if you took lemonade or pop and mixed it at room temperature to where it tasted the right sweetness, you'd cool it down and you'd drink it. You'd say, boy, that's not very sweet at all. Because the instant that cold pop hits your tongue, it deadens the sweet sensation, and so it doesn't taste as sweet. So cold pop in the United States has so much extra sugar to overcome the deadening sensation of the cold. That's why there's so many calories in pop in the United States. Be that as it may. All right, so here's this carbonic anhydrase. You notice there's a wide variety of histidines that provide ligands to hold the zinc electrophile in place so that zinc acts as a catalyst. And let's take a look at what the mechanism is here. Again, you have three factors. Binding, the metal ions help with binding. It shifts the redox states, helps move electrons around. And sometimes it actually helps shield and stabilize negative charges. So here's the imidazole side chains that are the covalently linked to the zinc. Now, imidazole, of course, that means it's what amino acid? Histidine, yes. Yes, histidine here, histidine there, histidine there, histidine there, here, histidine there, histidine everywhere, histidine. Histidine, imidazole side chains. So you've got the initial state of this is that there is a hydroxide ion linked covalently to the zinc. Here's the carbon dioxide at high concentrations, the negatively charged zinc attacks backside. The carbon dioxide produces this carbonic relationship. So you have this hydrogen carbonic acid. Water comes in to restore, to break the linkage, to restore the hydroxy. The hydrogen releases, and then you have this spontaneous carbonic acid base and the hydrogen ion coming off that. And that, of course, speeds the reaction dramatically. What is it, 1 million or 2 million times faster than the uncatalyzed state? All right, next is proximity and orientation effects. I wanted to make sure you understood what when I've got to go back. This diagram right here dealt, I got started on the ketone bodies, but this diagram here represented covalent catalysis. Represented covalent catalysis where this R group right here is actually physically associated with the enzyme. So at this shift base point where you see that R group actually represents the rest of the enzyme. So temporarily, the acetoacetate is actually covalently linked to the rest of the enzyme through that shift base. If you could stop it at that instant and take the enzyme apart, you'd find some nitrogen side chain that had that acetoacetate fragment on it. So it is that covalent bond there that's there that attaches, does allow for some shifting and then releases. There's the free enzyme. There's the free enzyme that allows for this kind of catalysis, covalent catalysis. Now, the next thing, proximity orientation effects. This occurs in all enzymes. This occurs in all enzymes. And you can see what... Let's take a look at the blanks. The first blank is close, orientation. The third blank is stabilize, and the fourth and fifth blank are called translational, and rotational. Eliminates various modes, translational and rotational. So the question here is, you know, this the proximity orientation effects. This is answering the question, are there universal effects offered by enzymes that enhance the rate of the chemical reaction? In other words, there's something that all enzymes do that help with the chemical reaction, either enzymatic reaction, and that's proximity orientation effects. And there's one other. Enzyme enhanced reaction rates. Well, that's a given, of course. In part, they do this. Notice I'm saying all enzymes, simply bringing the substrates and catalyte sites close together. They've done some estimations based on reactions that you'll see right here. Increases at about approximately 5 times on average. It increases the rate, simply helping bring the two substrates and the catalytic site close together and increases the rate 5 times. Binding the various substrates in proper orientation at 100 times increases. And then the charge groups that are in the catalytic site or in the binding site sometimes help stabilize the transition state. And we'll see that in a little bit with the oxyanion hole. And then finally, you eliminate various motions such as translation and rotational between the substrate and the catalytic site. And that, if you can see here, increases it 10 million times. Example. Now, let's take a look. Here, we're gonna use this. This is not in your text, actually. I've copied it from another text, but it's a very, very nice example of proximity and orientation effects. Proximity. What's a synonym for proximity? Synonym for proximity. Closeness. What's another synonym for orientation? Shape. Position relative to each other. Okay. All right. So here we've got a very com- this is we're going to try to make an ester. In this case, this is actually an anhydride. You've got an acid and an ester here, and you'd like to combine these two to make an ester and with a reasonably decent leaving group. And notice the table. Relative rates of anhydride formation for esters possessing different degrees of motional freedom in the reaction. Okay? So, this actually deals with both proximity and orientation effects. Here are the two substrates. Here is the product. What it's difficult and unusual for us to mention or realize is these two substrates are freely movable in solution. Freely movable in solution. I need somebody who doesn't mind being embarrassed a little bit to do a little dance with me, sort of. Anybody? Any volunteers? Do I have to do this by myself? I will. Okay, fine. I won't. All right. Okay, so I'll just do this by myself. And I don't know. Okay. All right. Well, here, I could. Let me do it this way. Maybe I wouldn't even have to embarrass myself. Those two things are going to be represented. The two reactants are going to be represented by the long meter stick and the short meter stick. Okay, do you see the analogy? The top reactant and the bottom reactant. Now notice, this is what it looks like in the picture. Is that correct? What's actually happening in solution? What are they doing? Are they like this in solution? No, they're doing this in solution. All right? They're doing this in solution. Okay, in three dimensions. I'll move over here. Hide your computers, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, they're doing this in this. So how often are these two reactive sites, right here and here, going to just randomly run into each other? Are they going to do it at a high rate? No, they're not. Because these things in solution are tumbling and turning and twisting in three dimensions. They're moving relative to each other, all like this. That's what's happening inside your cell. The enzyme is tumbling and twisting, and the substrate is tumbling and twisting. Okay? Now, so, notice what they have here. They have these two things. They have these two things independently, and they call the relative rate of that production of this compound, they arbitrarily call it 1. Now, what did they do here? What did they do here? Well, they said, and I wish I had some tape, but they said this end, maybe I can do this. And I got 3 more minutes, and then I turn into a pumpkin. Okay. Here's a piece of tape. See, I don't know if you can see this. Here's a piece of, it's not going to work. Never mind. All right, well, the reactive end is here, and the reactive end is here, for example. So what they've done is, rather than waiting for these to arbitrarily and capriciously accidentally run into each other, what they've done? They have taken a series of hydrocarbon linkages, CH2, 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 and they physically connected these things together. Physically connected them. Now, as soon as they're physically connected, does that reduce the degrees of tumbling and freedom for both of them? Yeah. It does two things, doesn't it? Notice what do those two arrows mean? What do you think is what's happening with those two arrows? Well, it means that they can rotate around each other like this. Okay, they're rotating around each other, but nevertheless, they're still much closer together than a free tumbling. Notice what happened with the rate of increase. This is now moving at 1,000, the catalytic rate's happening at 1,000 times faster where these two things react. They remove another carbon, and so it links them even closer together, reducing the degrees of rotational freedom, and that goes up to, 20,000 increase? And here they fix these two. They put a ring there. They fix them in perfect position relative to each other. They fix them in perfect position relative to each other. And bingo, as soon as they're fixed in space at the proper distance, the rate goes up to 50 million times faster than the freely tumbling materials. All enzymes do this. All enzymes help hold the reactants in the correct position, and that alone increases the rate of reactions. despite the catalytic mechanism simply reducing the degrees of freedom, enhancing the likelihood that the two reacting pieces of the substrates are going to be in the proper orientation, automatically increases the rate. So enzymes reduce translational and rotational freedom between the substrates, between the substrate and the enzyme, and that alone dramatically increases the rate of reaction. That's the proximity orientation effects. Now, catalysis by preferential binding in the transition state. All right, so I've got to finish this step. It doesn't matter. Okay, so the first blank is active. Next blank is substrate. Next blank is strongly. Next blank is increase. Next blank is inhibitors. Inhibitors. So write that down. Active, substrate, strongly, increases, inhibitors. All right. So I need somebody to shake my hand. Who's actually, everybody's writing down stuff, aren't they? Okay. Now then. Would you mind shaking my hand? Okay, now hold on here. Notice, if you would, hand is open. He's the enzyme. I'm going to be the substrate. All right? And how do I want to do this? Yeah. And so we're going to shake hands. As we shake hands, notice what happens to the shape of the enzyme. Notice what happens to the shape of his hand. Okay? Now then, just freeze it like that. And I'm going to release. Now then, the enzyme is shaped like that. That's the perfect transition state. That's the shape for the transition state for moving between one from the substrate to the product. What happens is, as the substrate comes in and binds with the enzyme, it's forced to assume that perfect transition state shape. The enzyme forces the substrate to get that proper shape. And when it does that, that increases the percentage of how... Thank you very much. Increases the percentage of how many transition states there are. The more of the enzyme substrate in the transition state there are, the more product you're going to produce. So the enzyme shape forces the substrate into the proper transition state shape, increasing its population, thus increasing the likelihood of getting product out of it. That's what that means. The active site conformation changes to fit the substrate better. Substrate conformation changes to mimic the transition state shape. For an instant, the active site binds the ideal transition state very strongly. Catalysis increases sharply because the concentration of transition state species is now relatively high. Non-reactive transition state analogs are potent enzyme inhibitors. Okay, here's the point. You got a bad enzyme going on here. May I borrow your pencil? You got a bad enzyme, okay? This enzyme is causing a disease. Put it in the transition state. This bad enzyme is causing a disease. You want to kill that enzyme. So what do? You make a compound. I better not do it this way. Make a compound that's exactly similar to the transition state that this thing's waiting for. What did I just say? You make a compound that's in the exact same shape this transition state is waiting for. Okay? You come in. Boom, it binds, but it's got a little suicide thing. It's got a reactive piece that permanently binds to that enzyme. Now then, that substrate analog will not release. What happens to this rogue enzyme? It doesn't work anymore. It's dead, and the disease is ameliorated. So transition state analogs are potent inhibitors. Transition state analogs are potent inhibitors. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. You guys have a great time taking the quiz. Mr.